Good evening. With all the talk that's going round about inflation, the fuel shortage, and the scarcity of help, I think it's a good time to take you back to the lush days when Newburyport, Massachusetts was in flower and that grandiose gentleman, Lord Timothy Dexter, was in his prime. He was the fellow who sold warming pans in the tropics, carried coal to Newcastle, and secured a housekeeper to help his wife by inserting the following ad in the local newspaper. Wanted: a good housekeeper, not less than 25, no more than 35 years of age. She need not be handsome, but should be comely and willing to serve day or night. She must have a good mind and a good constitution. Be converted, go to meeting, and stay in nights. She must take good care of my house for $1 a week. And if she does well, when I die, I will leave her enough money to buy a good husband. Signed, T. Dexter. There are as many stories floating around Newburyport about Lord Timothy Dexter today as there were ships in the harbor when he lived there. Books by the dozen have been written about him. And Mr. George C. Carter, the Dun and Bradstreet man of Manchester, New Hampshire, has spent a lifetime digging up little-known facts about this unforgettable character. Whenever Mr. Carter lectures about Lord Timothy Dexter before Rotary clubs and such, folks always ask, how did a poor, uneducated man get so much money in such a short space of time? Well, we'll come to that in a minute. I wanted to know about Dexter's early life. So Mr. Carter leaned back in his chair and told me that Timothy was born in Malden, Massachusetts, in 1747, during a snowstorm, of poor but honest parents. From Dexter's later writings, and there are none like them anywhere, we surmise that he was no great shakes as a scholar. You probably remember that he wrote a small book called A Pickle for the Knowing Ones, and because he didn't understand where punctuation marks should go, he filled 2 pages at the back of the book with commas, periods, question marks, and so forth, instructing his readers to salt and pepper the pages to suit themselves. When Dexter was 8 years old, he was bound out, as they used to say, to a farmer in Malden, with whom he worked and lived for 7 years. After that, he went to Charlestown to become an apprentice in the leather business. And there he stayed, scraping and tanning hides till he was 21. In those days, when a boy became of age, his employer gave him a freedom suit, and Timothy got his, a jacket and a pair of breeches made of the best guinea cloth, which Timothy called his freedom suit. But he didn't keep it very long. Cold, hard cash was what he wanted. So after saying thanks and goodbye to his employer, he hustled to the North End and sold his freedom suit. Then, with a few coins jingling in the jeans of his old tanning togs and his bundle in his hand, he trudged down the old bay road toward Newburyport, where he was to find fame and fortune beyond his wildest dreams. Naturally, he walked, and it took him 14 days to get there. As he stivered along through Ipswich and Rowley, he stopped to watch the lazy blue water of Parker's River winding through the Mash, little dreaming that someday he would go flashing over that same bridge in a coach and four of his own with all the trimmings. We can assume that being a tanner of hides, he pursued that unsavory occupation in Newburyport. But a year later, he branched out and married Elizabeth Mary Lord Frothingham of Exeter, New Hampshire, whose husband had just died, leaving her 4 children, a fine house, and some money. Timothy told his new wife that Newburyport was the coming center of shipping and culture, and got her to sell her house in Exeter. And all 6 of them moved to the port and took a little house on a hill on a side street near High Street. Here they went into business. Mrs. Dexter ran a little store where she sold knickknacks, and Timothy made gloves and breeches in the basement. They called their shop the Sign of the Glove, after a big wooden hand that hung over the door. They worked and saved and prospered. When the Revolutionary War came along, Timothy Dexter saw other men getting rich in the privateering racket. All you needed was an old boat or two, some guns and powder, and a letter of marque from the General Court of Massachusetts, and you could go out and capture a British ship if she didn't sink you first. 2 of Newburyport's leading citizens, Nathaniel Tracy and Jonathan Jackson, owned a fleet of 110 vessels. And with them, they captured over 100 enemy ships and cargoes worth $3 million. Like everyone else, Dexter dabbled in what he called speculation, buying a few odd shares in the various ships that sailed at the foot of his street. Some of the vessels that he owned shares in were captured or sunk. But when one did pay off, Timothy invested his winnings in continental currency and state bonds. His friends warned him, his wife scolded him, but he kept right on buying the paper money. until one day she screamed, "Timothy Dexter, don't you bring home any more of that worthless money stuff. We've got enough now to paper the pantry." And then the war ended, and there was unemployment, inflation, high prices, and low morale. Everything went haywire, and some of the rich men, like Tracy and Jackson, lost everything they had. When the soldiers came home loaded down with paper money the government had given them, the Yankee storekeepers shook their heads. "We want hard money," they said. "That scrip stuff ain't worth nothing. Why, it took $10 worth to buy a pound of tea, and a calico dress cost $150 in paper scrip. Folks were flinging it around as they did German marks in the last war. That is, everybody but Timothy. He went clean off the deep end and bought every scrap of scrip he could get hold of. And then a miracle happened. In Washington, Alexander Hamilton established a national banking system. The government took over the state debts. The worthless paper scrip became valid, and Timothy Dexter had more of it than he knew what to do with. As a gorgeous butterfly emerges from a lowly caterpillar cocoon to spread its wings in the spring sunshine, so did Timothy Dexter emerge from his tattered shirt and leather apron. The vision that suddenly appeared before the noob reporters was so startling they still talk about it. And no wonder. Nothing like it has been seen or heard of before or since. Like Napoleon, Timothy Dexter was a short, stocky man. To make him appear taller, his tailor designed and built a huge three-cornered hat of red, white, and blue velvet, embroidered with gold braid and adorned with tassels that dangled in the breeze like the fringe on top of the surrey. To give his sharp, pointed Yankee nose and piercing black eyes a more aristocratic frame, he frequently sported a beautiful powdered wig, and when occasion demanded, he had a laced jabot at his neck. To complete the red, white, and blue getup, he wore a well-tailored military cloak of dark blue, a shining white vest, and scarlet trousers. His very special shoes, which he designed and had fastened in France, had long, curving, turned-up toes with tassels hanging from the points. He was, for the time being, the undisputed pin-up prince of Newburyport, a truly great prince in his own estimation, but at the moment, a prince without a castle. But he'd had his eye on one for a long time, the biggest and most beautiful mansion for miles around, the palatial home of Nathaniel Tracy, shipowner and merchant extraordinary. Timothy had stood in front of that mansion one day in 1789, in his shirt sleeves and leather apron, with hundreds of other people, anxiously watching a cloud of dust in the distance. The autumn air was filled with the smoke of burning leaves and the sound of fife and drums. Down the turnpike thundered a royal coach, bearing no less a person than a newly elected President of the United States, George Washington himself. He had come to have dinner and spend the night with wealthy Nathaniel Tracy, the first citizen of Newburyport. Timothy elbowed his way through the crowd and gazed with awe toward the Tracy mansion. Through the big windows he could see spotless linen and gleaming silver, beautiful ladies in gorgeous gowns, elegant gentlemen in powdered wigs, all waiting to greet George Washington. Timothy stayed till the doors closed behind the president. Then he trudged up High Street to his own little house at the sign of the glove, thinking the while how wonderful it must be to have books, painting, music, big fireplaces, and a whole cellar full of wine. A little later, when the post-war depression came, and Nathaniel Tracy lost his fortune and his ships, and had to put his big house up for sale, doggoned if Dexter didn't up and buy the mansion, lock, stock, and barrel. Newburyport couldn't believe it, but there he was with his wife and his two children, Nancy and Samuel. In the topsy-turvy turn of things, the lowly maker of gloves and leather breeches was eating while Lafayette had wined and dined, and snoring while Washington had slept. Within a month, Dexter had bought a coach and four, hired servants, set out trees and flowers, and stocked his wine cellar. In regal splendor, he drove to the shipyard and ordered the construction of two big, fine vessels. He hired agents all over the country to buy anything and everything that was a bargain. He filled his stores and warehouses with the greatest assortment of stuff ever gathered under one roof. You've probably heard about the local wag who stopped Dexter one day and said, "Timothy, did you ever consider sending warming pans down to the West Indies? I hear they ain't got any down there. They'd go like hotcakes." "Is that so?" he said. "Well, I guess I'll try it." And before the day was done, letters had gone to his agents to buy every warming pan in the United States of America. According to Dexter's own diary, He bought 42,000 long-handle warming pans and shipped the whole lot of them to the tropical islands. It was the joke of Newburyport. And folks couldn't wait for those boats to get back so they could give Dexter the raspberry. But the joke was on them. Dexter had promised his Yankee skippers a percentage on all the stuff they sold. And when the West Indies buyers came aboard ship to see what was new from up north, the captains trotted out the warming pans and said, "Look, look what we've got. The very latest thing for dipping molasses. A ladle with a nice long handle." And by jingoes, they sold every last one of the warming pans, and Dexter, laughing up his lace-covered sleeve, cackled, "They thought I was crazy, but I made 79% on that deal." Well, 2 years later, he called the captains together and said, "This time, boys, I have a nice cargo of heavy Scotch mittens for you fellas to take to the tropics." "Mittens," they cried. "How can we sell mittens where it's 90 in the shade?" "Well," Timothy said, "you sold the warming pans, didn't you? And remember, you still get 2%. Well, folks, when they arrived in the tropics, they found the wooden handles had burned off the warming pans, so they sold half of the heavy woolen mittens to molasses men to keep their hands from being blistered by the heat, and the other half to the sugarcane growers as protection against mosquitoes. Sometime soon, I'll tell you how Timothy got his title of Lord Dexter, and how he purchased 2,000 tomcats and sold them at a handsome profit.